Today is Wednesday. It's May 25th, 2022. It's 2:40 in the afternoon. Hi, I'm John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals podcast, portions of which are broadcast on WGN Radio, Saturday nights at 8. You can hear all of me from 10 to 2 weekdays on WGN Radio.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the horrified and heartbroken publisher of the Picayune Sentinel and occasional columnist for the Daily Herald.
Yeah, this is a hard day for all of us to talk about anything, especially what happened in Uvalde, Texas. Austin, I know this is kind of complicated for you. Your fiance is a grade school teacher, right? Or works with students in grade schools?
Yeah. I've just honestly been pretty sick to my stomach all day about this, and it's hard to talk about. The teacher who was killed there was a fourth grade special ed teacher, and my fiance worked as a fourth grade special ed teacher for the past several years, like 7 or 8 years. And so, yeah, it's been hard to read about. I don't like reading about it. I've had to force myself to kind of look at some details of it, and every detail is more horrifying than the next in many ways. And yeah, I'm thinking of all of the educators who have to go into school environments today, and they know they're going to, one, have to talk to their class about this, and two, you know, thinking of their students whose parents may have guns at home, and just feeling incredibly uncertain about, is there someone in my school? I mean, obviously the odds are extremely low, but it's impossible not to have to reckon with, which is horrible. Like, is there someone in my school who is capable of doing this? And it creates this sense of such palpable fear, and just a sickening sense of fear in schools. And I really haven't put together many thoughts on it beyond, it seems to me that school shootings in particular have become almost this social contagion, where similar to how you would have a kid in a high school who's nihilistic and on the wrong path, wanting to wear a swastika to school or something like that, just to show people that everything you stand for and every part of the way the world works, I'm against. So I'm going to do something that is so horrifying to all of you because I hate all of you and I hate the world. This sort of an act falls in line with that kind of mentality.
Yeah.
And we saw the same sort of thing with the Buffalo shooter.
And it just seems like there's no way that your fiance or any other teacher can confidently tell themselves, well, that couldn't happen here. That
right.
Nothing about this shooting suggested that, and there's no comfort that you can take in the fact, and this is, you know, it goes back, you know, I wrote quite a bit about the Lori Dan shooting, which was 34 years ago this week in Winnetka. And everyone was saying, well, how could it happen here? How could it happen here? And the thing is that we've come to realize over time that not only can it happen anywhere, but the body count can be just enormous. It was one child who was murdered in Winnetka. There, or what we think, 19, is that what it is now?
Yeah.
Or is it, it's 19
plus
students
two.
And two adults. And going into a classroom and talking to students and trying to convince them, you can't tell them we're safe here, because clearly there's no place that's safe from this kind of carnage.
Yeah.
And my heart goes out to educators and parents too, who have to send their kids off to school and worry. And I don't know the answer. I did see that there was some talk about putting armed guards in every school. One of the Republican governor candidates said he will make sure that every school in the state of Illinois has armed security guards. And Ted Cruz and other politicians are saying we need armed guards. But the studies on this have not shown that would help. In fact, there was a study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association that found that putting armed officers into schools actually increases the likelihood of casualties, and it makes kids less safe. There's more room for error when there's a firearm there. The officers get split-second decisions wrong, and school shooters, some of them are actively suicidal. So an armed officer could be an incentive rather than a deterrent. So that doesn't seem to be an answer.
That proposal in particular, it gets trotted out by Republicans every time this happens. And it's so far-fetched, this arming teachers thing of like, we're going to find people who are both incredibly adept at somehow getting 20 kindergartners to focus on one thing all day. And also they're going to want to and learn how to hold and wield a weapon in class is so insane. And is so absurd that I don't know how a self-respecting person could see what happened and propose and talk about that in any kind of serious way.
And consider that the security guard Aaron Salter in the Buffalo slaying was killed by the assailant in that supermarket because the assailant had an AR-15 style rifle and was wearing body armor. And the security guard, I'm not sure what weapon he had, was probably a pistol on his hip. And that's just no match for somebody who is determined to do one of these mass shootings. So that clearly isn't the answer, but I don't really know what is. I heard Steve Kerr's impassioned plea for them to do something about this. I don't know. I feel like I gave up 10 years ago after Sandy Hook that anything would really get done, that we had, 26 people killed in Sandy Hook? And nothing happened. So I don't know that another 21 here in Texas is going to make any difference either. But it's so dispiriting to talk about something like this. And I, like Austin, I've kind of stayed away from some of the coverage because it just makes me feel sick and helpless.
Kerr was advocating for H.R. 8, which has been off the radar for a lot of us for a while. It was first proposed in, I think, 2019. The House passed resolution to shore up the gun show and online loopholes in gun sales. They want mandatory universal background checks before you get a gun. At a press conference today, the governor of Texas said that strict gun laws in Illinois are not protecting the people of Chicago, so that's all the proof he says he needs, that tighter gun legislation doesn't work. I think the problem with that is it doesn't have to be the answer. It just has to be a good idea. It just has to be helpful. Do I think that H.R. 8 is, I've looked at it, I read the bill today, it's not very long, a little longer than the Second Amendment, but it's not real complicated. It simply said that if you're going to transfer a gun from somebody online or at a show, they need to be licensed, and that doesn't seem to be too complicated to me. And then I saw what one of the Republican congressmen in Pennsylvania said about his opposition to H.R. 8, even though it did pass his chamber, 240 to 190. It's now before the Senate. It doesn't look like it's going to come up for a vote, and it wouldn't pass under the current rules anyway. He said that H.R. 8 would turn law-abiding Americans into felons simply for donating historic firearms to a museum, the transfer of the weapon. He said if you were temporarily loaning a hunting rifle to a friend, you would be a felon. If you lent a handgun to a friend to protect their family, you would now be a felon. That's the problem with this. He said that it's a bill of false promises. You know, some of that stuff is, in fact, patently not true, and the rest of it is preposterous. I asked Congressman Kastens about this, and he just paused and said, well, that's stupid. That was his reaction to what his colleague said. He goes, the politicians say stupid things all the time. Steve Kerr said it's not because they've got some sort of constitutional argument. They don't want to give up the power. They don't want to give up the money that comes their way. God bless Steve Kerr. He really did articulate what I think millions of Americans are thinking and feeling. We played the unadulterated 2.5 minutes of it today, and it really resonated with a lot of our listeners.
Yeah, and also it helps to remember that his father was assassinated. He was a university president over in, I want to say, Beirut.
Yeah, it was Beirut back in 1984.
So this kind of violence is a little closer to the surface for Kerr. And it was very powerful what he said, and the vibrations of his emotion were really powerful. In some ways, the idea that, well, we'll pass laws about these firearm transfers, they really aren't meant to get somebody who's lending a hunting rifle to someone. And the idea that the state is going to waste resources prosecuting someone for that is, as Representative Kasten said, stupid. You know, it might help at the margins. It's probably not going to help a determined mass murderer. like the ones we've seen in the last couple of weeks, that they plan these things out and they are going to be able to buy. There's no way you're going to stop the sale of these AR-15 style rifles, these rifles that are well suited to this kind of attack. That's just not going to happen. And so, but maybe you can prevent someone from just getting a gun. Maybe you can prevent some of these gun sale transfers where someone brings a duffel bag full of pistols and rifles up to Chicago and passes them out or sells them on the street. Maybe you can stop some of that trafficking, which will save some lives. It's probably not going to save the lives of the next students in schools, but it may save some other lives on the street.
Kerr said 90% of Americans support universal background check. And I went back and looked on that, and I found that statistic as well as the fact that 74% of NRA members support background checks, support more vigorous background checks. 74% of NRA members. Actually, let me see if it might have even been higher than that. But just leave it at that. Here's just two other statistics for you. 22% of Americans report acquiring their most recent gun without a background check. And nearly 1 in 9 people looking to buy a firearm on armslist.com are people who would fail a background check. So again, it's no panacea, but it just seems to be, you know, it's like throw us a bone. Like, I'm not sure that this is going to work, but think about how much good this would do if at the gubernatorial debates this week, one of them just stood there and said, yeah, you know, we'll all still be able to get our guns. We've got more guns in this country than we do people anyway, but let's just give the other side this. It'll shut them up for a while. I mean, let's just see how much that harms my ability to defend myself with a gun. I'll bet not much.
You said one of the candidates said that?
No, I said, wouldn't it be nice if they did?
Oh,
but no, they all reinforce their Second Amendment credentials, and they think that the FOID card in Illinois is all messed up. But not one of them just offered an accommodation, you know, lip service, just pay some lip service.
Richard Irvin had a lot of humbug going about, we need to support families and we need to support police. And I was just like, oh, what are you talking about? This is not going to answer. This does not solve this problem. It doesn't even sound good. That's the weird thing. It's like he's just dancing away from the main issues.
I got real defensive when Governor Abbott started to criticize Illinois and Chicago. Congressman Kastens said that the reason that we have more gun crimes in Chicago than they do in New York is because Chicago is next to Indiana and New York is not. 40% of the gun crimes in Illinois are committed with guns that came from out of state. I think particularly from Indiana. In all of these cases, though, I don't know, with that many guns and that many angry people or crazy people out there, if any legislation is in fact going to have a great impact. But at least we'd be able to look ourselves in the mirror and say we're trying. We're doing something. The candidates for governor in Illinois on the Republican side at these primaries, they said we need better fathers watching over their kids. We need more faith in God.
More support for the police.
More support for the police. Yeah, all of that. But not one of them just, like I said, or maybe we need to sort of shore up the loopholes at gun shows. Not one of them went down that path.
And didn't some of them, I didn't actually watch these debates because I was disgusted by the whole process. But like Austin, you did, right? Wasn't at least one of them saying that we should not have the firearm owner identification cards, so we should get rid of that?
Void the FOID is the name of that campaign, which I think probably comes from a place of that program just being so mismanaged. So even, I believe it was Richard Irvin said, I reapplied for this, which is good. That's good that people reapply for this FOID license. And he said it took him a year to get it. So I think, you know, the pro-Second Amendment folks
It was during the pandemic. Nothing was going smoothly during the pandemic.
True. But there were extraordinarily long. I remember even during the Rauner administration, people being like, oh, the FOID process is completely messed up. And I think those folks see it as it's a threat to their Second Amendment right, because it essentially just delays their ability by such a long amount of time to to legally to own a firearm. So yeah, it's very, I don't know if you guys feel this way, but I find almost any political response to these, I find myself growing much more cynical at. And it's almost like, so I appreciate the sincere expression of emotion from someone like a Steve Kerr. I thought that was really good. And then as soon as it goes into these policy discussions, it's like, are we discussing the prevention of mass shootings? Are we discussing the prevention of guns across state lines? Is it all firearms in general? It just becomes so fraught so immediately. And I think this Indiana thing is a good example. Like, yeah, screw a Texas governor taking pot shots at Illinois after a massive tragedy just happened in his own state. And then the other side of my head thinks, well, Chicago has had an enormous increase in homicides. There's a massive homicide problem. That's not correlated to a massive influx of guns from Indiana. That's been happening 20, 30 years. It doesn't explain the fact that it's rising a lot. For example, you'd think if it was that tightly correlated, we would see a huge rise or fall in guns because you'd rise or fall in homicides, but we don't. It's not that closely tied. And that, I think that's what's so hard about this issue oftentimes.
Is that we don't know why Chicago has the homicide problem or what the solution is?
So, for example, like we have these conversations, like let's address root causes of the gun violence problem in Chicago. And then some people will say, oh, I think fatherhood is a really good idea. And other people will say, well, I think it's more poverty. Like it seems like there are very, very few folks who are actually able to get legit legislation done and lay out a long-term plan that isn't simply reactive to the moment and actually gets at some of these problems. And that's what's frustrating.
And I think we can stipulate that stronger families, better education, better healthcare, all those things would go into reducing violence, but those are not immediate solutions, and they may not deal with people who are really on the margins. It's not clear to me. I don't think we've found out yet about the shooter in Texas, but I don't think the shooter in Buffalo had sought mental health care. I don't think that he identified himself as being mentally ill. I don't know about this other guy. So, and I don't know that either of them came from particularly impoverished backgrounds or had particularly fractured families, that this is the kind of, that these kind of people are grown in some awful petri dish on their own. I guess the reports out of Texas are that this shooter had a speech impediment, perhaps,
yeah,
and was bullied,
yeah,
as a child. And so he was taking revenge on that. Again, you know, these are sort of, I think, as John, you pointed out, we're sort of going down a couple of different paths. And should we do something to try to fix some of this or ameliorate some of it, even though whatever we do is not going to stand in the way of the next person who decides he wants to shoot up a school?
Right. And I guess the reason for why I think the political discussion can ring so hollow, at least for me, is that, can you imagine a story, you know, in the 60s of some kid getting bullied in high school for a lisp? And then the result of that is a mass shooting in a school. It's not as if there was much less access to firearms at that point than now. But so, like, what are we to make of that? Like, it's an extremely frustrating conundrum.
And you're not suggesting you have the answer to these questions.
No, not at all. Not at all.
But the intractability of the other side is what frustrates me. So while we don't even know what the best question is, Austin, what bothers me is that the gun owners in this country don't even be willing to try. They don't seem to, they throw up their hands like you are and say, well, that's not going to work, and then nothing changes. How about we try a change, see if that helps? I mean, H.R. 8 I keep going back to, but Lord knows Steve Kerr's in my ear right now. I'd like to see how much good or harm that does. By the way, this is from the governor today, the apples to oranges comparison. I'm reading from Tinus von Dellis in the Sun-Times. The apples to oranges comparison did not fare well, Texas to Chicago, with some of the state's top Democrats, with Illinois' Governor J.B. Pritzker tweeting, shame on you at Governor Abbott. You're lying about Chicago and what actually perpetuates gun violence. The majority of guns used in Chicago shootings come from states with lax gun laws. Do better. You have 19 kids and two teachers who deserve our best. Alderman Gilbert Villegas was even more pointed, referring to the Republican governor. There's a word I'm not supposed to say on our podcast, and telling him to keep our city's name out of your mouth. We'll move on to other things with that same frustration, Austin. Yeah, so now what have we accomplished here? What's changed? We are as vulnerable tomorrow as we were yesterday to this. And that's not a good feeling. I understand why you feel that way, particularly given your proximity to that kind of a situation.
Yeah, and I would encourage everyone to reach out to educators you know in your life and give them a little tap on the shoulder maybe give them a call.
And then feel free to call a Republican senator. By the way, so we did talk about this gubernatorial debates. Three of them appeared on Channel 5, the Republican candidates for governor, and three of them went to Channel 9. That broadcast was simulcast on WGN Radio. None of them advocated for stricter gun laws. Richard Irvin still wouldn't say if he voted for Donald Trump in the last election. He trotted out the "that's what J.B. Pritzker wants you to talk about." Did you guys think that, I mean, so everybody knows who Richard Irvin is, the mayor of Aurora, that's got $50 million behind his campaign, courtesy of Ken Griffin. And then there's this downstate lawmaker named Darren Bailey, who has millions of dollars behind him, not as much, but is keeping it close. Did you discover anything about any of the candidates that was interesting or surprising to you? Did anybody move up or down the ladder, Austin?
I find oftentimes in these debates, and I felt this especially with the NBC debate, where I don't know if you watched it, John, but the question and responses were so quick, so rapid fire, and so jumping kind of all over the place that It was very difficult for anyone to really give a sense of their deeper thoughts about hardly anything. It was just sort of these reactive, I think some of our questions were just simple yes or no questions oftentimes, and they would try to filibuster. And so I think it's almost, I don't know, maybe I'm just like Mr. Cynical today. It's almost like a test. It's almost like watching someone take an SAT or something. It's like, what I'm going to take from this is how well do you perform in this setting that is pressure filled and you're kind of dealing with difficult questions. I don't even know if that's the best way to choose a governor. Maybe it's one metric by which we should judge them. I think on that metric, Darren Bailey really struggled. I didn't think he presented himself in a gubernatorial way, in his debate. I thought Jesse Sullivan, definitely in terms of just pure debate performance, did very well. And Richard Irvin was in an interesting situation because if listeners don't understand this, it was quite a confusing format because essentially two competing networks held two competing debates back to back from each other. So not all of the leading candidates were in one debate. They were split between two. There's, Irvin, Schimpf, and Max Solomon in one, and Rabin, Sullivan, and Bailey in the other. So Irvin was really debating two people who are in, 1-3% in the polls. And so he was kind of, it was kind of a lose-lose for him in a way because he was answering very tough questions for Republicans to answer. And he wasn't really able to talk about his leading opponents. So,
and he was a nervous wreck.
All in all, very confusing.
He was his opening statement, he lost his train of thought. And then he struggled to recover twice. Suddenly a little moisture started to appear under his nose. I wanted to flick it. And I'm like, holy cow, dude, get a grip. This is easy. And I think Marianne Ahern can be a tough, host, but
inquisitor,
yeah. That's the word, thank you very much. I'm so nervous, I lost my train of thought. Oh my god, I'm sweating now. And I'm like, dude, get a grip. He had an attitude like, don't make a mistake, I've got two softball opponents here, all I gotta do is get through this thing. And for the first time ever in watching a debate, I actually wanted the candidates to go longer, like, are you for background checks, yes or no. And then she was so interested in moving the thing along, she was almost afraid to say, could you expand on that? Because then sometimes you can't shut these people up. But they were all just trying to dodge these questions with answers that were so short, you didn't get a lot of context there.
Eric? Yeah, I agree. Go ahead, Eric. Sorry.
Well, I didn't watch, as I pointed out. I sort of boycotted this debate.
Well, then why are we going to Eric? Austin.
I just want to issue a complaint about this, which is I think that this was a massive failure on the part of the TV stations, the managers, the producers, and the moderators, everybody, not to get together and combine these debates somehow. either one station stand down or they do a simulcast. But the fact that they didn't flip a coin, they didn't agree to have all these candidates on the same stage together and be the adults in the room, that they, that the candidates, you know, some had agreed to WGN, some had agreed to Channel 5. And the result was, I thought, two meaningless events. And I wasn't going to watch it. I wasn't going to watch Irvin go up against the undercard and watch Bailey debate the other people on Channel 9. It just seemed like this was a huge failure on the part of the TV stations. I haven't seen that said enough, that you need to get these guys on the same stage. Now, next week, next Thursday, there's a debate scheduled for Channel 7. And Darren Bailey is saying that he can't come because he's got to go to the Northwest Suburban GOP Lincoln Day dinner, which is just so, if he's not smart enough to see that a televised debate on a major market network O&O is a better exposure for him than a Lincoln Day dinner in the suburbs, then he's too dumb to be governor. And if he's using this prior commitment as an excuse not to go head to head with Irvin, then he's too much of a coward to be governor. I mean, it's just ridiculous. This whole debate thing has become such a cluster event, and I just don't understand it. And I don't know how it doesn't serve voters at all.
Well, so, I'm with Austin that in principle, who said debates are the best way to pick a politician anyway? Say you'd have brilliant ideas and you'd be a good leader, but you're not a good debater. That's a thing not everybody has. And yet we've decided that if you don't do that well, then you can't be president or governor or mayor.
Yeah, maybe this is total heresy to say on a fine legacy news institution like WGN Radio. But I think in some cases, major media institutions are actually ill-suited to host debates of this nature. So like, for example, the NBC debate, this is the people watching this who are making a decision based on this are Republican primary voters. So like the red mediest of the red media, right? But you have a lot of questions there that aren't really, I found that the candidates were answering a lot of questions that would be, their answers to which would be completely irrelevant to the Republican primary voter base. And I think probably the same thing happens on Democratic primary debates too. But I would, as long as we're on the subject of improving debates, I did find that to be a little lacking.
By the way, we're going to edit everything you just said out for the broadcast. But like, what would if they did a bit? Right. So serve Republican primary voters. What should they have talked about more then? What would be those meatiest of the red meat topics for them?
Yeah, I think it would probably just be budget, life,
Second Amendment,
Second Amendment for sure.
Abortion,
and have questions come from Republican primary voters. I think that would help.
Do you not think that that fealty to Donald Trump, loyalty to Trump, whether you voted for Trump, is an important issue to Republican voters? Because there was a very interesting exchange that I read in which Marianne Ahern was pressing Irvin, did you vote for Trump? And he kept saying, well, that's what J.B. Pritzker wants you to ask me. And when I drive around the state, people don't want to know that. And Marianne Ahern said, well, actually, I think voters in your primary really do want to know whether you voted for Donald Trump. They want to know your relationship to Donald Trump. I think that's a really important question. And he may be able to dodge it. We have a little bit more than a month until people go to the polls. He's been dodging that question relentlessly the entire time.
The problem with him, I do think it probably is a legitimate, you know, thing to spend time on for sure in Republican primary debates. But Irvin puts himself in a trick bag there because on one hand, he's saying it's not important and only J.B. Pritzker wants us to talk about it. But then every mailer out of his campaign is about how his opponents are not loyal to Donald Trump. So clearly, his actions would suggest that it is a very important topic to Republican primary voters. So I don't think he could have it both ways.
Well, he's trying to have it both ways. Eric, you unearthed something. I was clicking through Twitter and you found a previous mailer by Irvin where he would send one thing out. What was it, to Democrats? It said one thing and then send something else out to Republicans. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. He was, and this, I did not dig it up. It was dug up by my former colleagues at the Tribune. They did a Rick Pearson authored and Ray Long did a great profile of Irvin, looked at his past as the mayor of Aurora, and they looked at his some of his mailings in his most recent mayoral campaign, and he would identify households by party, and he would send one note to one of the to the Democratic households and another note to the Republican households, really trying to have it both ways, which is clearly what he's trying to do in this primary. He's trying to leave himself room to run hard to the middle should he win the primary on June 28th.
So. Which is a legitimate strategy. And I'm not actually, the more I thought about what you and they were talking about on Twitter today, the more I thought, well, he wasn't lying. He said, here are the people that have endorsed me. And it was these Democratic groups. And then he sent that to Democratic households. And then he had Republicans and police officers that were endorsing him on the other side. And he sent that to Republican households. And never once did he mention that he was saying something else about the other side in the mailers. I don't know that that's dishonest or unethical or anything like that. Eric, how do you score that strategy?
It's like playing the field when you're dating, right?
So. It kind of is. And
you're the only one for me.
I always bring this up, my frustration with the fact that you have to run so hard to the extremes to win the primaries that then you don't get the best candidates in the general elections, or they're so compromised in the process. But I think people like you, Austin, say, oh, don't worry, people will forget about that. For instance, if Richard Irvin's a Democrat, could he win if he said in the Republican primary that he did not vote for Donald Trump? Do you think he could win the primary? Because I do think that would aid him in the general election. Austin, answer that.
He clearly thinks that it would be a major problem.
Yeah.
And I think he's probably right, because you would have candidates, you know, all day running those ads. But, you know, the big Trump card, so to speak, is going to be who he endorses, if anyone, in the race. And I think this race could completely change overnight, depending on whether Donald Trump decides to make himself a part of it. So.
Although we did see last our Tuesday night in Georgia, the limits of Donald Trump's political weight. He tried to get the Secretary of State,
Raffensperger,
tried to get him defeated, and he failed there, and he massively failed in his attempt to get Purdue elected.
Raffensperger won by about 50 points. So Raffensperger over, what was that the guy's name, Jody, trying to remember who the opponent was, but he won by a lot.
He won by a lot, but he just narrowly avoided a runoff. He got 51-52% of the vote. The gubernatorial primary, where Kemp just slaughtered Purdue, I think, by 50%.
Maybe that's
points.
The 50 or so, yeah.
That was the one that was really dramatic. So Trump's primary endorsement record is mixed, but this one was particularly important to him because he, for some reason, seems to think that Georgia was key to his alleged claims of being cheated out of the presidency, and he got his hat handed to him there. Although, you know, at other places around the country, he's done decently well. So, but just to circle back a little bit to what Austin said, I think it's definitely true that if Trump weighs in on this race and he gives the thumbs up to Bailey, would be the logical one because Bailey is right behind Irvin in the last poll we saw. That could easily put Bailey over the top. I don't think Bailey is electable statewide, but especially his hostility to Chicago. That he, I just read about this. Can you elaborate on that, Austin? What he said about Chicago? Call this a hellhole or something like that?
Well, I mean, the bigger thing with Bailey in Chicago is he co-sponsored a bill to separate Chicago from the rest of the state, which, I mean, plays great in Effingham, and you can get a whole lot of downstate voters with you on that, but winning in a general election, and I think other Republican candidates have made this point, winning a statewide election where, you know, common general knowledge of this is, or the rule of thumb of this is, like, Republicans need to get 20%+ of Chicago and Cook County to win statewide, becomes very tough if your record shows that you want them to live in a different state. I think that's fair.
Guys, I don't mean to make light of the news this week. We've had a hard run of news lately. The pandemic, the economy, the war in Russia, Ukraine, another violent spring in Chicago. Our teams aren't winning much. Weather's been bad. Murder hornets coming up from the south. Monkeypox. I thought, when I saw monkeypox, I thought, are there any of the plagues left? Really? We've got to deal with that emotionally or mentally. I guess all of that to say that it's understandable why people are on edge. So when Lori Lightfoot was confronted today at the city council meeting, she just lost it. They were talking, and Austin, maybe you can catch us up on what it was that was the flashpoint here between the mayor and Alderman Sixto Lopez. But I guess it was about the casino. He was critical of the lack of transparency and the speed by which the process took place. The city council today, the full city council did approve the Bally's proposal 41-7. But he was being critical. Was that it, Austin? And that's what
she was actually went nuts over a different issue with him. Not to say that maybe the Bally's thing played a role, but Black Hub Chicago did a report on this today. And the background is essentially in Chicago, we've talked a lot about aldermanic privilege on this show, right? Like aldermen have this de facto power in their ward to make all these sort of ticky tack administrative decisions. And that is one of the reasons that we have so many aldermen that go to prison, because they are bought off to make these sort of small potatoes decisions like licensing and zoning. So one tactic that aldermen often use to sort of make special interests or moneyed interests come to them on bended knee is down zoning a property. So, for example, if I have a property that's zoned for, say, allowing a residential complex with 1,000 residents, if I'm an alderman and I know that that building's going to be sold soon, I have an incentive to say, actually, I'm downzoning this plot of land so that you could only build a single family house here if you were to demolish that whole 1,000 person housing complex. So then if somebody wants to buy that building and build something bigger or build something that has a different purpose, they're going to have to come to me, negotiate with me, the alderman of this ward, before they do anything. So it's kind of a power play. And Sixto Lopez was doing this with a church in, I believe it was in
Pilsen.
In Pilsen, right? Yeah. So on 17th Street, there's a big church in Pilsen, probably going to be knocked down. We don't know who's going to buy it yet. And Sixto Lopez was doing the same tactic, basically saying, I'm going to downzone this, so any developer who wants to do anything is going to have to negotiate with me and all these community groups before anything is done. Lightfoot allies, Alderman Spezzato and Alderman Revoiras, did a move when Sixto Lopez tried to do this called defer and publish, which is basically tabling his proposal and kind of killing it for now. And that totally blew up. So Sixto Lopez called out the mayor for this and totally disrespecting aldermen. And then Lightfoot, in a very Lightfootian manner, seemed to blow up at him.
Woodian manner? What kind of manner?
Lightfootian, he said.
Lightfootian manner.
Or Lori-esque, maybe.
That's better.
She is shouting at the top of her lungs. She said, you are a liar. You are a liar here. I sit here and I will not tolerate you besmirching the hard work of so many people who have worked on this. She went on to say, you may not agree. You may not agree. Then vote no. But I will not sit here silently while you besmirch the reputation of the people that work for me from your pettiness of the things you're trying to do that expose this city to liability. Sir, almost every word that comes out of your mouth after you say your name is a lie. She said, you're a liar. These are blatant lies. You're out of order, et cetera, et cetera. Wow. And I mean, she was angry. She was just screaming at the top of her lungs and just pounding it. And it was one of those instances where the more she yelled, rather than sort of sating her frustration, it just made her angrier. She kind of welled up rather than cooled off. And I don't know what to make of that. Maybe that's par for the course, or maybe something else is evident there, Austin.
It just doesn't. Here's the problem. This is like, I feel like my constant, our constant battle, where on the merits of something, she's right, but there is no political, like, what Chicagoan knows or cares about this issue or Byron Sixto Lopez? Like, I doubt most people even know this is going on. So to make this huge scene about it, only to make yourself kind of look petulant and kind of silly and unhinged, I don't understand who this benefits at all. To sort of like publicly undress this alderman in this way, especially, and it's especially frustrating when she's on the right side of this issue. She could have easily just said something like, Alderman Sixto Lopez, the fact is the Chicago City Council has had more than 30 aldermen go to prison over the last 40 years. And it's mostly because of powers like this. So maybe you have your best intentions at heart in downzoning this property so that people have to negotiate with you. But the fact is the power structure is broken and I can't abide by this. Instead of that, all we get is headlines about how our mayor is sort of acting like a petty child. So it's very frustrating. And obviously this isn't the first time this has happened on an issue where she's correct.
Yeah. And it really plays into this idea that she does not know how to get along with people. And so she can't get things done that need to get done because she's constantly alienating people and not showing herself in control. You can't imagine an executive with confidence and command behaving the way mm-hmm. Lightfoot behaves. And, mm-hmm. and I just don't see any, and people will say, oh, this is sexist or something. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with just her not seeming to be able to control her emotions at a time when, the way Austin said, it would have been perfect. You could cut somebody like that down to size if you're the mayor with a few choice words that would look really good in the newspapers the next day and will sound really good on the newscast at night if the news even bothers to cover it and get the same point across. I think that this is something that will really play into voters' minds when they're thinking about who they want to run the city for the next 4 years.
Yeah. Pat Quinn might run, the former governor. Boy, talk about a different demeanor. But I so agree with what you said, Eric, that I've often said I don't know if she's a good mayor or not. I don't think I'm smart enough to know if her policies or her strong-arm tactics are what the city needs. But the more she has these sort of outbursts, which I think sometimes are judged under a sexist lens, but the more she has these kind of outbursts, this was not that, the criticism of her, the observation of this, the more I think you're not a good mayor. You're not a good collaborator. Who wants to work with you or for you when that's you? So bad mayor.
I don't even think I wouldn't even describe it as strong arming. It's kind of weak arming.
Yeah.
Or like, yeah. No arming. That doesn't look strong. It doesn't look strong at all.
You're exactly right, Austin. It does not look strong. It's like when you see a parent lose their stuff at a child, you don't think, well, that parent's in control. That parent is out of control. And that is the same kind of feeling you get watching Mayor Lightfoot, which is this is not how a strong, confident mayor behaves. It's how an insecure, brittle, thin-skinned mayor acts. And we don't need that at this time. We never need that.
I don't have time to go down this path, but then who's next in line? You know, who is the somebody that you're going to be for nobody or whatever? Who's the next strong candidate right now, guys?
I think the next, obviously we had, not obviously, but there was reports that both Pat Quinn and Brian Hopkins were mm-hmm. out in the field with polls, kind of judging, testing the waters to see if they might run. I expect Paul Vallis to enter the race at some point, probably in the near future. And you do look at someone like a Vallis as, especially on this point, kind of, he is for sure a policy wonk. He knows how the city works. And I think his challenge in the election, in this race, will be, can he make a distinction for himself on this question of like a demeanor? Does he have the proper demeanor to serve as mayor? And can he contrast that with Lori Lightfoot?
I'm a little intrigued by Cam Buckner, who's the Democratic state representative. He's chairman of the House Black Caucus. He threw his hat in the ring 2 weeks ago or so. I don't know a whole lot about him, but he has been sort of sounding some law and order themes, and it'd be interesting to see where he goes. But he might have a pretty strong constituency that make eat it. And of course, Willie Wilson is out there now. He's giving away grocery coupons
today, $25 and more gas tomorrow. Yeah, gas Thursday. So,
and that's got to be a better investment in my mind than some of these TV commercials that you see. Right?
How interesting, Eric, because then all the newsrooms are providing him the equivalent of advertising.
Anyway.
Yeah, yeah, right, right. Well, one more thing, guys. In 2019, Tim Anderson of the Chicago White Sox said he wanted to be the Jackie Robinson of modern baseball, and the barrier he wanted to break through was the boring barrier. He wants to make baseball more fun, more exciting, bat flips and all. The Yankees' Josh Donaldson has been teasing Anderson, calling him Jackie repeatedly. And this weekend, the two teams came nearly to blows. MLB suspended Donaldson for his words, The league said they were unfortunate, but MLB did not characterize them, that is Jackie, as a racist comment. We asked our listeners if they felt the one-day suspension was right, and 43% said it was not severe enough, 29% said it was the right suspension, 28% said it was too severe for Josh Donaldson of the Yankees. I know how I feel about MLB's judgment on this, but Eric, why don't you go first? What's your thought about this, including the one-day suspension?
Well, first of all, the MLB statement said essentially that they thought that it was disrespectful, that what Donaldson said to Anderson was disrespectful. I agree that it was probably disrespectful, meant disrespectfully. Donaldson tried to play it off as a joke. I don't think that it was a joke. I think he was needling him, teasing him about saying back in 2019 that I kind of feel like today's Jackie Robinson. That's the kind of thing that you do to kind of get under the skin of an opponent. Trash talking in sports is it's a way of life in sports, and it can often be disrespectful. Michael Jordan was a legendary trash talker. Larry Bird was a legendary trash talker. Guys were out there disrespecting each other all the time. I think that it was pearl clutching for MLB to say that you can't be disrespectful to one another on the base paths. That's not the world we live in. I wish we lived in a world where sportsmanship truly was valued, but so I think they were reacting to the suggestion that it was a racist remark, and I don't see any evidence for that. If Anderson had never used his own name in conjunction with Jackie Robinson, then it would have been a pretty odd thing and potentially even racist for Donaldson to bring up Jackie Robinson's name, but he did. Anderson did say this to Sports Illustrated. I kind of feel like today's Jackie Robinson. That'd be like me saying, I feel like I'm the new Mike Royko. And people would then be entitled to tease me mercilessly for not being the next Mike Royko. That's fair game. So I think the suspension was uncalled for.
How about you, Austin?
I don't know. I feel like I never know how to judge the proper length of a suspension. So, for example, like, Joe Kelly, a pitcher for the White Sox, made this point. And I generally like Joe Kelly as a pitcher and kind of he's a funny, interesting person. And he said, Josh Donaldson is a D-bag. That was sort of, you know, what he said. And then also mentioned that I got an 8-game suspension for like making a silly face. So Joe Kelly back in, I think this was 2020, he threw a couple pitches at Astros players. And then a player was really mad at him and he kind of turned and made this like fake pouty face. And he was suspended for, it led to like a benches clearing brawl, but he was suspended 8 games for that. So yeah, Eric, it's a very fine line between trash talk and racism, I guess, is what we're, what we're kind of debating. I mean, Tony La Russa came right out and said, that was racist. Don't do that. But what was weird, and I guess this is where I think the rub is Donaldson kind of justified it as an inside joke, like referencing the fact that, oh, we've joked about this before, which seemed to not really be true at all. I don't know.
That was clearly rubbish. And it kind of aggravates the offense such as it is by saying that. He should have just said, hey, I was trying to get into his head. You know, that's what we do in sports. And if he can't take it, then maybe he shouldn't compare himself to Jackie Robinson, you know, and then they could take it out on each other next time they see each other. But this whole thing felt really blown out of proportion. And I loved that Anderson hit a 3-run homer in the nightcap of the Sunday. Tim Anderson is a great player. He's leading the majors in hitting right now, probably destined for the Hall of Fame. He can back up his trash talk, certainly, with what, and he can even back up this Jackie Robinson comparison, maybe, you know, but he's a great player. And the fact that he hit a home run and went around the bases in Yankee Stadium with his, you know, finger to his lips, you know, shushing the Yankee fans who had been chanting Jackie at him, which he's probably going to get in other ballparks as he goes around the league because this was made such a big deal of. And I think everyone should have ignored it.
Trash talking and taunting is part of sports. I don't have a problem with it. I would be no good at that, so I never did it or wouldn't endorse it for me personally. But Reggie Miller was a colorful basketball player. It was part of the Michael Jordan package, and I don't remember us saying, oh, gee, you shouldn't say that to Bill Laimbeer. He's not going to like that. So that's, you know, I think that's just one of the tools in your bag if you're good enough to talk the talk and walk the walk, and some of those guys are. So I think Tim Anderson has that coming after he says that, but it is a black and white issue. Tim Anderson is a black man, Josh Donaldson is a white man, and so it's not like the Royko thing that you referenced, Eric. It is kind of apples and oranges there. The racial issue is inherent in this conversation with the baseball players, and there's no underlying issue like that when somebody would have taunted you for being Mike Royko.
I suppose that's true, but what you seem to be saying, though, then, is that it is impermissible for a white player to taunt a black player or to trash talk a black player, which I don't. I mean, certainly Larry Bird trash talked to everybody in the league back in when he was playing. I don't think that that should be our standard. I mean, if we want to say no trash talking, no disrespecting other players, then let's make that the rule and start suspending people.
Which you can't do.
Which you can't do. And again, just because Jackie Robinson is black and Tim Anderson compared himself to Jackie Robinson, but I don't even think that his comparison was racial. He was saying that he wanted to bring fun into the league the way Jackie Robinson brought African Americans into the league. It's kind of a weird thing to say, but you know, it was a long interview. People say weird things. And so Donaldson took advantage of that. It clearly wasn't a joke that he was teasing him about it. He was taunting him. He was needling him, however you describe it. But I don't see the fact that Donaldson is white and Anderson is black and making it racist or even or racial. I don't see it. But
it would be easier to dissect this if he wasn't a renowned D-bag, if everybody didn't know that he is capable of saying stupid, mean, hurtful things, and maybe even racist things. I don't know that about him, but I could just see people copying that on there, and now we're calling it that. And Tim Anderson clearly took it that way. That's where this lands for some people. It's not what your intent was. It was how it was received. And if Tim Anderson decides that that was a racist remark, or if Tony La Russa calls it that, then therefore it is. I don't think that's a fair way to score something like that.
I haven't followed every last statement of this, but I don't think Anderson has ever said that it was racist. He definitely said it was disrespectful. Everyone needs to move on from this. And I hope that this doesn't completely dog Anderson's season, that he isn't greeted by chance of this at every visiting ballpark that he goes to.
Yeah, well, I do think that MLB did get it wrong in a one-game suspension. They said it wasn't a racist remark. It was an unfortunate, disrespectful remark, so therefore we're going to penalize you with a one-game suspension. Well, what happens when somebody else says something, taunts somebody else? Are we going to now throw a one-game suspension there? No, I think what MLB said was, really, that was a racist remark, and we're not going to tolerate that. But what they've then said, it's like my colleague Lauren Lapka tweeted, thanks MLB, racism equals one game. Got it. And that's really what they have done here, even though they didn't label it as such. I think they either needed to not penalize him at all or penalize him more severely. Call it what it is. I mean, where are you on this, MLB? Was that a racist taunt or not? If it was, he misses a week or 10 days. If it wasn't, then Tim Anderson's just got to take it. But they got it wrong. They split the child, and I don't think that satisfies anybody. Before we go, guys, producer Peach has handed me a couple of things here. Colin Kaepernick. This is from Adam Schefter, who has last played football in 2016. Gosh, it's been 6 years. The same year he started kneeling during the national anthem to protest racial injustice, is scheduled to work out this week with the Las Vegas Raiders, according to league sources. I don't know how old he is now. Do you guys know how old Kaepernick is? Is that in this story here? But I think if he's able to play in the NFL and contribute, think about all of the years, productivity, money, and touchdowns that were lost. He's 34 years old in my year, 34. Wow. And also breaking from our colleague Heather Sharon, the Chicago City Council has voted 30-19 to extend and expand the city's teen curfew, ratifying Mayor Lori Lightfoot's controversial response to a spate of downtown violence. So the city council has done what they said the mayor shouldn't have done. Now they've done it. And so the extension of the curfew is in place. Any last comments from you, swell gentlemen, before we sat down today? I said we're going to do a quick one here today, and now we've gone as long as we usually go. Any last comments from you, Mr. Zorn?
I'm really rooting for Colin Kaepernick. I think that what happened to him was really disgraceful. So I'm hoping that he still has it, but I would kind of doubt it after 6 years off.
Call a teacher and tell them you love them.
Yeah. Yeah, we all will second that. That's Eric Zorn and Austin Berg. I'm sorry that Brandon Pope, our colleague who knows sports and is a black man himself, wasn't here to comment a little bit on the Tim Anderson conversation. But all of our other colleagues are off doing the things that they do. I'm glad the two of you are able to join us. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Pete Zimmerman. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Thanks, John.
Okay.
Thank you, John.
Yeah, well, Austin, thanks. Thanks a lot. I know that wasn't so easy for you today. You did a real good job. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it was really awesome.
Thank you. Sucked. I appreciate you guys. Yeah. I wish I could go to the 100-year thing, John.
Yeah, no kidding.
West this week.
That's why I'm wearing my blazer with the jaunty pocket square too right now.
What is it 5 to...
Are you coming to this thing? Are you going to bust down?
I was invited, and I'm on my way out of town, so I might stop by. It depends if I can make it. What's the timing on it?
Throw on some decent slacks and come over.
This is not okay, my little buddy?
No, what you're wearing now is not appropriate. I don't even know what that is that you're wearing right now.
It's like a really furry hoodie. I can clean up a little bit, though.
Yeah, I've seen you better than that. It starts at 5, man, for a few hours. So come get a sandwich and a cocktail or something.
I think I will do that. Not right. Cocktail, because I got to be driving. But anyway.
All right.
Thanks,
see you,
guys.
Boys. Good job.
See you, bye.
Have fun. Bye. Yeah.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.